week of June 5th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 324, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in Nashville, Tennessee, Michael Giltz?
Hanging out with Dolly Parton. No, I'm just visiting friends in Nashville, then headed to Atlanta and then Birmingham, Alabama. Heading down south for the summer. I got lots of trips, lots of trips. I could be in Ann Arbor. I could be in Boston. I could be in Florida. I'm headed to Orlando, Florida in a couple weeks, probably after July 4th weekend.
Is this because the music industry has now proven that you cannot make money unless you're on tour?
That's right. I'm going home to home, visiting our Showbiz Sandbox families one at a time to chat with them. And for $20, you can have me over for dinner.
Only $20, you're a cheap date.
And get a t-shirt. Well, and dinner. They pay for dinner.
Good point.
We're not eating at the house. We got to go out.
Okay. Well, then what's the point of having you over?
And we hang out. We spend time together. It's quality time where I can be annoying in person, not just over the phone. And of course, I'm going to Orlando in a few weeks. You're going to Orlando right away, aren't you?
That's right. Next week, there will be no show because I will be, hey, you know what? Harry Potter called. And he said, hey, could you come on by my place in Orlando, Florida? There's a whole amusement park that your kids should see that I've built, and I'd like you to bring them along. And so,
how old are your kids?
11 and 9 and a half, so almost 10.
Have they read the books, any of the books, the first book? Where are they?
They have read all of the books.
Oh, wow. Way to traumatize them. Death. Crime, horror, enjoy, kids.
Spoiler alert. And they are now rereading them. I mean, they really love these books.
Well, duh. Of course they do. Now, if you were going to be anywhere in the world when you loved Harry Potter, this week, next week, it would not be Orlando, Florida.
It would be in
London, where they're beginning previews of Harry Potter, the new stage play, which is a sequel of sorts to the Harry Potter world. Harry Potter is an adult. He's got his son. His son is headed into school and dealing with the family legacy.
I guess he's 11 years old, the son, because that's when you get invited to Hogwarts.
Ah, he's a legacy, so maybe he knew at 10 he was getting in.
Yeah, maybe.
I imagine if you're the son of the boy who wouldn't die, you get to go.
Maybe. I don't know. Are there rules like that?
There's certainly complicated rules with the Academy. We know that, don't we?
That's right. In fact, on this week's show, we're going to be joined by Los Angeles Times reporter Travel Anderson to talk about their story on diversity in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. The Academy has been saying for years it wants more women and people of color. The LA Times said, what about these people? And then they listed 100 notables from all areas of the industry worthy of membership, including everyone from Tina Fey and Idris Elba to casting directors and cinematographers. During Inside Baseball, we'll talk about the response they're getting from the people listed, Hollywood, and the folks who vote on the Oscars. We'll hear who's talking to the LA Times about this. I look forward to that. We'll also discuss the extensive reshoots on the next Star Wars movie, Rogue One, and whether that spells disaster and an earthquake is shaking Sony, where they're in the midst of executive shuffles. So it's not a real earthquake. It's an executive earthquake. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from Rentrack.
Oh, well, actually, Michael, that it's not Rentrack anymore. It's Comscore. Comscore is the company that purchased Rentrack.
That's right. When I type in Ren as in Rentrack, I forgot. It redirects me to Comscore. That's right. Why is it Com? Why is it? Is it computer?
Commerce. They're keeping the score of commerce just for you.
All right. Okay. So we're linking to Comscore in our show notes, where we pull their box office worldwide chart. We also buttress that with information from Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, the LA Times, of course, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is X-Men Apocalypse, another $100 million over the weekend. It's at $400 million worldwide, which is just about what most of the X-Men movie have made, except for one that blew up to $700 million. So it's tracking well as far as X-Men movies are concerned, but it costs almost $200 million to make. So it does need to make $700 million worldwide in order to be profitable.
It needs to make $700 million worldwide. Let's face it.
Yes. And number two around the world is the sequel to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This one is Out of the Shadows. $70 million over the weekend. Poor reviews, just like the first one, and not a great start to the franchise with 41 territories checking in, but we'll see where it ends up. And number three around the world is Johnny Depp's movie, Alice Through the Looking Glass. $41 million over the weekend, $175 million worldwide. This has already been falling hard in North America and not doing great overseas compared to the first one, which is an out-of-nowhere worldwide smash that made $1 billion. Was this movie hurt by the legal ramifications of Johnny Depp's divorce, where his wife, Amber Heard, is accusing him of beating her and got a restraining order?
I think that that happened a little too close to the opening of the film, to the opening weekend.
Well, but I mean, if
maybe Twitter in later weeks.
And feedback can have that kind of rapid effect where Thursday night and Friday suddenly poisons the rest of the weekend, why not? Oh, he beats his wife. why doesn't that hurt the box office? I see what you mean, and I kind of agree. Why wouldn't that have the same sort of quick, you know, rapid fire effect?
That's a family film, so I don't know necessarily that the kids are saying, you know what, mommy, I don't want to see that movie. You know, I hear, the person who plays the Mad Hatter, I don't know, he might be a little mad. In fact, I think he beats his wife.
Yeah, and that's ugly. Your instinct on anything like that, because in real life, 99.9% of the time, it's true. If someone says they were raped, they were raped. If they say they were beaten, they were beaten. And it's true so many times that you can really discount the ones where it's not. It's somehow a little different when it's two celebrities and you're fighting over millions of dollars of an estate, not to accuse. I assume she's telling the truth, but one hates to just leap and say, oh, he's guilty. You know,
well, especially,
it's
weird.
It's a weird world.
Yeah. And he's had way too many relationships.
Maybe otherwise we'll step forward. Well, and say,
yes.
You know,
and
what?
If that started to happen, then I don't know how we got on this tangent.
Well, because, you know, I feel like with Bill Cosby and other, all there's constant things, you know, you don't want to downplay domestic abuse, nor do you just want to say, oh, he must be guilty because it was mentioned once by someone. You know, it doesn't seem fair either way, but it's ugly. And we hope, everybody gets justice in the courts, and we don't like to think about it and talk about it. But if you ignore it, then you're helping the problem, aren't you?
I don't know.
I mean, if Hollywood looks the other way and says, we don't care if he beat his wife, we want to put him in another movie.
Yes, I mean, but I think if you're going to say something like that, back it up with evidence and take it to court.
Well, she has photos and she has a restraining order and she has stuff, and we'll see where it ends up in court. But it's ugly and sad. And number four around the world, also ugly and sad on a far more less important level, is Warcraft. $30 million over the weekend, $70 million worldwide and counting. This one will have to make it up overseas. It's opening up this weekend in North America, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, it is, but it's not tracking well. So they're not expecting it to do particularly good numbers. It is in 28 territories so far. It's a pretty good-sized budget movie, $160 million. That's a big roll of the dice. So, they're going to want to make that up in the international territories.
Well, hopefully they can, because it's not getting very good reviews.
Well, no, but it's not the type of movie that usually would.
Good point.
And number five is a movie that got sort of surprisingly not bad reviews. It's the Angry Birds movie. $26 million over the weekend, $280 million worldwide. It's quadrupled its reported budget, as far as we can guess. So, hey, everybody's the Angry Birds are now a little happy, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and as you said, Michael, and I probably shouldn't say this since it's your joke, but it's the best, your most favorite mobile app game, or your most favorite movie based on a mobile app.
Have I ever said my most favorite? I don't know.
I don't know. You know what? I probably shouldn't have said that joke because I just can't say that joke.
At number six is Me Before You, yet another in the dying teens subgenre. $25 million over the weekend, a great opening for this movie that only cost $20 million to make. It's based on the novel by Jojo Moyes. They sort of lumped it in Hollywood with teen movies like The Fault of Our Stars and Me and the Earl and the Dying Girl, because it's young people in the movie. But Jojo Moyes is not a YA author. She's an adult fiction, sort of the romance section is where she often gets shelved. Chick lit, as some people would derisively term it, but she gets great reviews. She's very popular. She's from England. I look forward to checking out one of her books. I just haven't done it yet.
Well, wait a second. That's a whole subgenre, you say? The dying teen subgenre?
Well, I just named two of them. Why not? If you got three, it's a trend.
Okay.
That's what they said at Entertainment Weekly. If you got three, it's a trend. Not that I ever worked at Entertainment Weekly. I just freelanced for
them. I thought it was, if you have three, make a list.
Sure, or a listicle.
Yes.
And number seven is the 300th sequel in the Marvel Universe movies. It's Captain America Civil War. My friends here in Nashville saw it over the weekend, and the mom said, it's just too much punching. It's just people punching each other in the face for 2.5 hours. That was her review. $11 million over the weekend, $1,131 million worldwide. One of the 25 or 6 movies in the world that have ever grossed more than $1 billion.
Can you name all of them? No, just kidding.
I can get damn close to it. And number 8 is The Handmaiden. This won't make $1 billion, but it's a good, strong opening for Park Chan-wook's period drama. It's based on the novel by Sarah Waters called Fingersmith, but they reset it into Japanese-occupied Korea rather than in England, where the novel was originally set. It opened to $10 million over the weekend. It's a movie that debuted at Cannes. Did you see it? Was it any good?
I did see it, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a very good movie.
Did it feel like a typical Park Chan-wook movie? Because perhaps it seems a little more not crazy and out there.
Yeah, it's a little bit more
traditional
in its storytelling approach and in its visual approach. But it's definitely, it kept me enthralled.
Cool. And number 9 is Money Monster. That's the Jodie Foster film starring George Clooney. $10 million over the weekend, $66 million worldwide. Another modestly performing movie with not a huge budget is The Nice Guys. It costs about twice as much to make as Money Monster, actually. It costs $50 million to make, where Money Monster cost about $25 million. But they both have big names in them. Nice Guys stars Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. It made $9 million over the weekend. It's at $41 million worldwide. It's in 22 territories, and it's a classic example of a film where you should just wait and see. We don't know how many big territories it has to go yet. We don't know where it's going to end up. I mean, it's got a ways to go. It needs to triple where it's at right now just to claw into the area where it might be making money. But we'll see where it ends up. And number 11, already hugely profitable, The Jungle Book, another Disney film, $8 million over the weekend. That's about to hit $900 million worldwide. And then if we go on down to number 15, we hit Zootopia. I'm skipping over the Andy Samberg film Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping, which has a funny title, but is apparently not a very funny movie. That opened pretty poorly in North America. But Zootopia at number 15, as we predicted, as we expected and hoped, it did cross the $1 billion mark. It made $4.3 million over the weekend and grossed $1 billion worldwide.
Well, it barely made it past $1 billion. By $20,000, it made it past $1 billion.
That's right. It's $1 billion. $20,000. It's like a billion and change, literally. Of course, it's not done yet. It's still in 17 territories, so it's going to make a little bit more money. But yeah, this weekend, it almost exactly hit the $1 billion mark. That makes it about the 25th or 6th film in history to gross $1 billion. And it's one of only 4 movies that are animated to have hit that mark. Can you name them?
You're talking about animated movies, right?
That's right, animation.
Okay, well, actually, you know,
and we're not
there's 26 movies.
Inflation.
We're not adjusting for inflation. 26 movies have hit $1 billion. Number 26 is Zootopia. Okay,
that's right, because it just did it.
Right. At one, yeah, barely.
There's no movie that grossed $1,019,999. This isn't Final Jeopardy.
Yeah, or like The Price is Right.
Yes, there you go. I bid $10. I bid $10 and won.
Right. $10 and won, that would be $11, FYI. Toy Story 3 comes in at number 19.
Oh, you're looking at a list. Well, you're not guessing. Okay, yes, Toy Story 3, that's right.
And let's see what we got. Minions at number 11.
Right, and then Let It Go.
Frozen.
That's right. So those are the three movies, Frozen, an original, Minions, a spinoff of the Despicable Me movies. That's from Universal, of course. And Toy Story 3, a Pixar original. And Zootopia, now also a Disney film overseen by the Pixar people. So that's 3 out of the 4 movies come from Disney. Zootopia is a big success, $1 billion worldwide. And we've got a couple movies that are close there, right? We've got Deadpool has grossed $770 million. That probably won't make it. Jungle Book is about to pass $900 million. That could make it. And we've already got Captain America. That's over $1 billion easily. So a lot of movies this week made a lot of money at their time at the box office. But we've also had a wave of movies that have done poorly. They're sequels, and people are saying, people hate sequels. They're tired of sequels. What's happening? Hollywood's getting scared. We've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles doing a pretty poor opening. We've got Alice Through the Looking Glass, 6 years after Alice in Wonderland was a left field hit. That's certainly not tracking very well at all. And we've got X-Men Apocalypse, which I think is doing fine. They're painting this as a bad a result, but it's in line with all the others except one.
Well,
and it's not done yet.
To the point, I mean, I think, and I may have said this already, it's in a lot more territories today than some of the previous films were.
Well, all the other X-Men movies made $400 million except for one, which grossed almost 800 million. So this one is already at 400 million. It's racing along. Well, yeah, it's in as many territories as it can be. It's not cheating.
Yeah, just like all the other films were in as many territories.
Like 3 years ago, they didn't release them in a lot of territories, right?
No, but there were certain territories that they couldn't get into, China being one of them.
Well, yeah. That's whatever. We're just talking about, is this movie a success compared to all the other X-Men movies? And they feel like it's not tracking well, but they've never gotten great reviews. The best one is X-Men First Class, of course, but they've never gotten great reviews, and we'll have to see where it ends up. But we do have a lot of these other movies that are sequels that are not doing well. What do they have in common? Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Alice Through the Looking Glass, to a lesser degree, X-Men Apocalypse. Coming up, what else do we have? Well, we have Warcraft here in North America. That's a potential new franchise. But what they all have in common is that they're not very good.
Yeah, well, that's true. They also all have CGI. I don't know.
All have CGI. That's right. But, you know, they're not very good, and nobody wanted a lot of them. People were looking forward to X-Men Apocalypse as such. But the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, nobody was waiting for that. A sequel to Alice in Wonderland 6 years later when the first one somehow made a lot of money, but nobody really liked it.
Yeah.
Nobody was looking for that. You know, Hollywood keeps churning them out. When they make a sequel to a movie that they should feel lucky to have gotten away with, they're really risking the gods, aren't they?
Well, yeah. Okay. So I know that your big pet peeve is Divergent. That, like, hey, you know what? You're lucky that, you know, you didn't lose your shirt on that one. Maybe quiet down. Don't do another one. Instead, they do like five others.
Right. Well, that's the most recent example. But, you know, Hollywood sometimes does walk away. They try to launch a franchise and they make money, but they say, we're done. Like The Golden Compass.
That was the film that, like, basically sank New Line.
It did, though it did not. It ended up doing just fine worldwide. You know, it probably, you know, eked out a profit. And they said, well, they had two more to make. And they said, oh, I don't think so. And now it's becoming a TV series in the UK. I mean, it's a great property. The novels are terrific. Though, really, when you look at the books, turning the other two into movies would have been exponentially harder. I don't think they could have made good movies out of those two sequels, the two other books in the trilogy.
Well, what about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the English version? They made the first one, but then they never made the other two books.
That's right. A great example where they said, we're lucky. Tintin with Spielberg and Peter Jackson. They were going to each make a movie, one after the other. They're going to move Tintin coming through our ears. You know, Jamie Bell, terrific actor. I think the first one made money or just barely, but they said, maybe not. You know, they're not feeling it. They weren't happy with it. The technology wasn't ready. I'm sure at some point there will be a new Tintin movie, but they did not keep pushing that franchise just because they could. They said, we got lucky. Which is probably what they should have said with Alice in Wonderland and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, especially now that we have new Star Wars movies.
Every year, we're getting one.
Every
December, there will be a new Star Wars movie. And if James Cameron gets off his butt, there will be a new Avatar movie, at least for the next 5 or 6 years.
Do you think that maybe they should just, after you know, The Force Awakens, that they should just say, yeah, you know what? No, it just didn't work right.
No, because they got great reviews and made a ton of money.
Okay.
It doesn't fit the formula at all.
What about the these like spinoffs that they're doing? They got the Harrison Ford one in production, and this one, Rogue One, is also in production. In fact, it wrapped production. It's in post-production. It's due out in December of this year, and it looks like they have a little bit more work to do on it. And by more work, I mean more production work. Like they have to get...
They're doing 4 weeks of reshoots starting in a few weeks.
Yes. And this is, there's some rumors, again, rumors. So, of course, we have to report them as if they're true, because we're responsible journalists. And so, look, page 6 in the New York Post says, hey, people close to the situation, people with knowledge of the matter, are talking about how Disney may not be entirely happy with some of the advanced previews. It's too, they're calling the film
too dark. I don't think they've shown it to audiences, have they?
We would have heard
stories about what was in the movie if it had been shown to an audience. So no, that didn't happen. They looked at the footage and said, we're not happy.
Yeah.
If they were happy, they wouldn't say do another 4 weeks of reshoots. So clearly they weren't happy. Either it's too dark, which doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It just means they said, it's a little darker than we want, Gareth. Because he's the director who did Godzilla. That's the most likely explanation. That he said, I want to make a tough, bold war movie set in the Star Wars world. It's not going to be sweet and magical. It's about rebels fighting an empire. And it's going to be gutty and gritty and dark and like an early 70s gritty film. And that's what he delivered, perhaps. And Disney said, a little too gritty. Maybe less grit.
Yeah, because unlike The Force Awakens and all of the prequels and the original films, there's no Force in this one. This is just about a bunch of rebels. They don't have special powers. They're just going to steal the plans to the Death Star.
To be clear, there is the Force. It's just not characters in the movie are not showing the Force. The
Correct.
Force is a special talent. Not everybody has it. And these rebels are not imbued with the Force. So yeah, so not Jedi Knights. They're not heroes meant to save the world. They're just people doing a job. So yeah, there's 4 weeks of reshoots. That ain't great news. But it's hard. You can't say it's either a disaster or trouble or whatever. It's like, all right, they just need more work. Animated movies rip it up and start over. They do it all the time. They're doing it now. Sure, it's 7 months away from the opening, so it's not great. But it's plenty of time to do 4 weeks of reshoots and work it in and get the special effects done and create the tone that they want.
But so, the reality all these Star Wars movies have had, if not reshoots, they've had people, you know, kind of freaking out right before the movie opens.
Like what?
Well, I mean, in Skywalking, which is, it's Skywalking, George Lucas's memoir, his autobiography there that he wrote, he talks about how all of these people, Francis Coppola and a number of folks that he showed the film to said,
You mean the first one?
The very first one. Yeah, it's not good. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no.
And then Steven Spielberg was over the moon about it. He loved it.
I don't remember all those people. I remember the studio not being aware of what they had, particularly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There were all these memos that came out where, like, some of the executives were over the moon about it, and then there were others who were like, oh, my God, this is not going to work.
Right. Well, yeah, but that's different. I mean, that was the first movie. That's different from having a franchise and working on whatever. It's a small, low-budget movie. You know, that's a very different, I think, category than what we're talking about.
I think it's funny that you call Star Wars a small,
but it's not a biography or memoir. It's written by Dale Pollack. He may have cooperated with it.
Yes, he did.
But I don't think it's I don't think it's an all but official memoir. I think it's an actual, you know,
fictional story.
I mean, he was a critic. Yeah, he worked for the LA Times and worked. He was a film critic for Daily Variety. Dale Pollack. So he's not a lackey of Lucas who just wrote this book. So it is an unauthorized, straightforward story about, you know, George Lucas.
Okay, he's interviewed in it. So,
well, sure, that doesn't mean it's not his memoir. It's Dale Pollack's memoir. If it's your memoir, you've written it. You may have someone ghostwrite it with you, but you got to write it.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that reshoots on big major motion pictures like this, big blockbusters, they're not all that uncommon. J.J. Abrams, in his production schedule, actually schedules time in for reshoots. So,
right, it scares people, though, that this long after you've wrapped, you're doing another 4 weeks. It's something to talk about. They got a lot to talk about at Sony, though, don't they?
Oh, my
gosh.
They
don't need any reshoots to keep them talking.
No, although, thankfully, we're not talking about, you know, cyber attacks and hacks and, you know, unlawful publication.
They'd rather talk about that than how they got fired.
Right. Well, actually, in some of these instances, I wonder if maybe. So here, let's
what's happening? I don't even know. My head is dizzy from all these executive chair shuffling.
Okay. So first of all, Steve Moskow, let's start there. He is the head of TV at Sony Pictures Television.
He was.
He is leaving after, I think, 24 years.
Uh-huh.
He is generally credited with, you know, he joined Sony in 1991, and he basically turned Sony Pictures Television around and has kept it stable. He's got shows.
They've got The Blacklist.
The Goldbergs.
NBC's number one drama, or one of their top dramas. The Goldbergs, Jeopardy, Bloodline.
Yeah, so he's kind of seen as, he kind of knows what he's doing. And by the way, in the midst of all of it, Sony came in at 10 years after he had started and said, yeah, we'd like to take all the people you have working for you and, yeah, just let them go. And good luck continuing to run the studio, but, you know, we just can't afford them anymore. And so everybody thought, well, Sony Pictures Television, they're done. You know, they don't have anything going on because everybody's been laid off. But
so he was a great guy. He turned it around. He did a great job. And he's sitting there. Is he leaving on his own terms? Why is he leaving?
Well, he's leaving because he was in the midst of contract negotiations. His contract ends at the end of, sometime this fall. And he and Michael Linton supposedly just don't
see. Who is Michael Linton?
He is the chairman, I think, is his title, of all of Sony. And he just said, yeah, you know, the negotiations weren't going well. This is now.
Why wouldn't they be going well?
I have
He's doing a great job.
There were supposedly some headbutting from what reports have said that they just didn't get along or they didn't see eye to eye on a number of issues. And so Moskow said, you know, or Moscow, I don't know. It's M-O-S-K-O. He's taken off. He's going to leave on his own terms.
So is that a bad move on Linton? Has he let go an executive? That's a really important part of Sony.
Well, you know, there's two ways to look at it.
Right way and the wrong way.
Well, no, I'm going to give you two ways to look at it. And either way, will tell.
Well, if you're going to say yes, but maybe no, I'm not interested. I'd rather know your opinion as to whether it's a good idea or not.
Well, I think in this case, probably not, because he's actually done quite well, knows the business. I'm sure there's somebody who's going to step in that knows it as well, but he's actually a proven entity. The counter to that as well, it's time to get some fresh blood in there. Maybe, Moscow is not, thinking you're coming up with fresh ideas.
Not hungry anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. You can't know whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, whether that thought process actually holds true until a year or two or three down the line, when you turn around and look at Sony Pictures Television and decide whether they're doing better now or kind of just treading water, or
what's happening in the film side.
Well, in the film side, this is somebody I actually have known through the years, Doug Belgrad. Well, I first met Doug Belgrad. He is and still is until July 15th. The president.
was and still is until July 15th.
Yes.
He's the head of Sony Pictures Motion Picture Group.
Yes. So he's the...
The film guy.
He was Amy Pascal's loyal lieutenant, they're calling him. He's the the guy that...
she left in last year.
Last year was kind of pushed out very publicly. And at the time, it was, who's going to get the job? Doug Belgrad is second in line there, and he very well might get it.
Well, but if he's her lackey and you've kicked her out, why would you bring him in?
Well, because he knows what he's doing and he's been there
right,
for 20 years.
Right, yeah.
And so instead, they gave it to Tom Rothman, who had only been brought into the studio to run TriStar Pictures maybe a year or two earlier. And they kind of passed over Doug Belgrad, and everybody says, this is because, Doug was passed over. I think if he had been given the job, he certainly would have loved it and done a great job. But I think at this point, he's probably saying, if I'm not going to do that job, then maybe it's time for me to go off and do other things. Because let's face it, someone like Tom Rothman, who is known for being, not the easiest person on the planet to work with.
Nobody is in Hollywood.
Nobody is in Hollywood. Correct. You know what? He's going to
The main TV guy stepped down. The number two guy in movies stepped down. That's what we got going on?
Yeah. And he's kind of going off to set up his own financing group.
Yeah.
Which I could see him doing. I actually first met him, believe it or not, in 1991.
So you're old. Okay.
And he was kind of new at the studio. And out of all the resumes I sent out, he was one of the folks that actually said, hey, why don't you come in? We'll sit down. And I've known him throughout the years. Very nice guy, very personable guy. Everybody loves him. He really knows what he's doing. Everybody's saying, maybe it's Ghostbusters isn't doing well. You know what? The guy handled all three Men in Black movies. He handled Angry Birds. He'll do just fine. Ghostbusters aside, who knows if it's going to do well or not. At the end of the day, Tom Rothman, the head of the studio, brings in Sanford Panich, who was already...
He wants his own person, right?
Yeah, and I think Doug Belgrad said, I've been here 24, 25 years. Maybe it's time for me to... If I'm not going to do the big job, time for me to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And he's leaving.
All right, so the top TV guy is out. Number two in movies is out, replaced by Sanford Panich. Everybody's head is spinning. Is Sony going to be stable now? They've had those people in for decades, really.
Yeah, that's what's kind of interesting. Belgrad.
And Belgrad were in there for decades. That's a long time to be at a studio in that position.
And it just goes to show you, it's very difficult to keep your studio job for, any period of time.
What are you
time.
Talking about? We just talked to two guys who kept it for decades.
And that's what I'm saying. They are the exception to the rule.
Oh, okay. These two guys were there for decades. Yeah, it's really hard to keep your job.
Right. And thus why we're bringing them up, because, people leave studios all the time. We don't talk about it. But two people who have been there for over two decades, there's a reason to talk about it.
It's a big deal.
Oh, you're right. It is a big deal, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Nintendo's Pokemon is one of the most successful entertainment franchises in history. So why would they casually rename a beloved character like Pikachu? Turns out, in many parts of the world, the Japanese character Pikachu isn't called Pikachu after all. Nintendo is launching a new edition, and it decided to ignore countless regional dialects and, at least in China, stick with the Mandarin translation. It's easier for branding and marketing and consistency, but leaves fans who have grown up with, say, Indiana Jones wondering whether they suddenly have to call him Montana Pete. Indeed, it struck a major nerve in Hong Kong, where people feel their dialect of Cantonese is being squeezed out by the more dominant Mandarin, sparking protests, online petitions, and even people going to the Japanese embassy to make their displeasure known. Because, you know, China is a really well-known place to hold protests, public protests. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I think. You know, I mean, you're talking about 1 billion people in China and people with lots of different regional dialects suddenly finding their beloved character renamed. It's kind of wrenching. Frankly, I was in a grocery store in New York City, and the people at the registers, the employees, were talking about it angrily. They thought Pikachu was going to be renamed in America. They're like, what's going on? Why would they rename Pikachu? They were very upset. And that's how I heard about this story. So thanks to the folks at my local grocery store.
But he's only, Pikachu's only being renamed in certain territories, correct?
Right. And they've said when there's perhaps in India is another territory where there's lots of different dialects. China is certainly one where there's it covers 1 billion people with lots of different dialects, not just Cantonese and Mandarin, but also, you know, other regions with dialects encompassed in that. And they've said, oh, region wide in China, we're going to call them this. In India, perhaps they said, we're going to call them that. So if you speak, you know, something other than the language that we picked as the dominant one, you're out of luck. Suddenly your character is not called the Fonz anymore. It's called Hey Joey. You know, it's whatever it may be, it's been renamed. And that is wrenching. It tells a story about how difficult it is to deal with characters worldwide. What do you call them? What do you rename them? How do you treat territories? Do you get granular down the level of Hong Kong versus Shanghai versus Taipei? Or do you get, say, all right, it's all Asia. You know, it's like there's different ways to play these things. And they're finding that out.
Well, now, if your TV show is called Joey, or the character on your TV show is called Joey, does that mean you're in a sitcom that actually takes place in the future, which is a spinoff of a TV show which hasn't even begun airing yet?
Well, there was Joey with Joey, right, from Matt LeBlanc from Friends, so that already existed.
But the Fonz was like 20 years earlier. That's why I'm...
Right.
That was one of those brain twisters. You see what I did there?
No, I don't, but let's keep going.
Okay. Lin-Manuel Miranda, you've won the Pulitzer and will win the Tony for Best Musical. Where are you going?
I'm going to Disney World.
No, it's not official yet, but everyone expects Lin-Manuel Miranda to exit his musical Hamilton in July, maybe July 9th. He will have stayed with the show for a year on Broadway, and the rest of the cast has their contracts up as well. Up next for Miranda? Well, he's heading over to Walt Disney, so that helps. He's been working on songs for the animated musical Moana, which is set in the South Pacific and comes out in November. He's also been cast as the male lead in a Mary Poppins sequel alongside Emily Blunt. And yes, he's writing songs for that one as well. Talk about sequels we don't need. Oh, yeah. And he has an idea for a new show of his own, by the way. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think Hamilton will be just fine on Broadway. I actually think he's not the best person for the part he created. I think the character's more irascible and prickly, and he's so likable. He helps sell the show, but I think he's written a better part that some other actor can step into and like make an even more brilliant portrayal. So I'm excited to see it again someday, 5 or 10 years from now, when I can get a ticket.
Yes.
But yeah, he's got a lot of stuff going on. The whole cast does. People have been offered TV shows. Some of them are leaving for sitcoms. Many others are going to stay with the show for a while longer, and they want to bump and raise because they're incredibly talented. They're all going to win Tonys. Well, not all, but some of them will win Tonys. And they're like, hey, let's get a payday. They've all got a piece of the show, but it's modest. So really, being in a long-running show, it's really hard to let go of something like that, especially when you're a person of color and you don't get a lot of great offers made for you every day. Do you leave Hamilton to play, you know, third hooker on the left? And, you know, that's truly what you deal with in theater and movies and TV when you're a person of color. Look at The King and I. That show has just announced its closing after about a year. It's a shame because it has two new leads. They're both great. Marin Mazzie and the guy from... Lost, Daniel Day Kim. Am I saying his name right?
Yes, you are.
Both terrific. I have two different sets of people who saw the show, and they were great. And so it's a shame. But the rest of the cast, it's all the same from the people when it opened a year ago, because they're all almost all Asian actors. And frankly, They've got great roles and a great show. Why the hell would you leave? You don't have anything better staring you in the face. So, you know, it's no surprise they're there giving their all on matinees and evenings on Tuesday nights because they've got good roles and they're thrilled to have them and they're doing a great job.
Well, look at Book of Mormon. A lot of people, everybody said, well, Andrew Reynolds and Josh Gad were in that show. How could that show go on without them? Well, it's gone on just fine.
Well, that's a different issue. Those are not stars by any stretch of the imagination. The King and I starred Kelly O'Hara, who's one of the bright lights of Broadway. She finally won a Tony for Best Actress, well-deserved, for that show. But it was never doing that great, even with her in it. It did very well, but it was not sold out the way it should be because she's such a beloved Broadway fixture. So I'm not surprised. I saw the box office down. A show like Hamilton and the Book of Mormon, not star-driven. Despite the now fame of Lin-Manuel Miranda, people want to see him in it. No one's going to say they don't want to see the show because he's moved on.
Now, Lin-Manuel Miranda isn't the only one saying goodbye. After more than 30 years on the radio, the syndicated talk show Loveline is calling it quits. Dr. Drew Pinsky, who hasn't aged a day since taking over that show, he went from being a guest on the show while still in college and getting his degree to becoming a regular member and finally the host. The call-in show, where viewers, or listeners, ask questions about dating, sex, drugs, and the like, skyrocketed to stardom when Pinsky paired with Adam Carolla. The two became media darlings with their own show on MTV, cameos in movies, and more. Carolla left after a decade, but he returned to tape the final show alongside Dr. Drew this April. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. It had a great run, but I didn't even know it disappeared. I was very sad to hear about that. I first saw the show on MTV, and then I realized it was a radio show. Found it online when I was traveling somewhere. Online, I should say, on the radio when I was driving somewhere late at night. So I started to listen to it then.
Amazon is turning Japanese. Okay, not really, but the website is bumping up the original content on Amazon Prime that is created by and for Japan. They've got 12 original productions slated in the next year, including a spinoff of Ultraman, a variety show hosted by a comedy duo we assume our Japanese listeners are familiar with. I don't know, they're called Summers and, oh my.
Teruyoshi Uchimaru.
Thank you. And a period drama about four young men sent to Rome as ambassadors. That sounds like a fish out of water story. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's been happening all over the world. It's no surprise. They got 12 shows. That's one show a month, though, for the next year, which sounds kind of modest, and yet it's a lot. So, I mean, there's 196 countries around the world. What are Netflix and Amazon Prime going to do? Are they going to have original content in every single country?
No, but they're going to do a lot of, language. They're going to focus on languages, I think.
Well, sure. They want French, Spanish. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They start with, Hindu, Cantonese, Mandarin. You know, they want all those. So that makes sense. Japanese. But again, there's a lot of countries in the world. Creating content for all of them seems almost impossible.
The classic film, October Sky, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, has been turned, guess what? Into a musical. Twice. And that's not good news. Homer Hickam is the writer who penned his memoir Rocket Boys, the story of his childhood in coal mining country and how Sputnik and a fascination with rockets led him and some friends to experiment on their own, leading Hickam to win a prominent science fair contest and leading him out of a life working in the mines and straight towards NASA. The book was filmed as a movie even before it was released, and both proved very successful. Now, after several sequels and other books, Hickam turned his memoir into a stage musical called Rocket Boys. Unfortunately, Universal thought that was a great idea and turned their movie into a musical called October Sky. And both have enjoyed regional productions. Now Hickam is suing Universal for $20 million, saying they are squashing his rights in various ways. Universal says, hey, we get to turn our movie into a musical if we want. So there. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, people suing people, but I've known about it for over a year and I couldn't say anything. I interviewed Homer Hickam for his new memoir about his parents when they first met called Carrying Albert Home. I recommend it highly. It was a very fun picaresque sort of road novel set during the Great Depression when his dad and his mom wanted to return an alligator. I should say alligator, said crocodile, an alligator. Wanted to return an alligator to Buddy Ebsen down in South Florida. Because his mom dated Buddy Ebsen, the guy from Beverly Hillbillies, And she always held him up to her husband as, oh, the man of my dreams. If only I'd stay with Buddy Ebsen. And they got married and she had this wedding gift of this. I think it's a crocodile. This is funny because it's a running joke in the book. And he said, it's me or the crocodile, because the crocodile kept snapping at him. And she said, well, we can't just turn him free. We got to take him back to the swamps of Florida. So they go on a road trip through the Depression down to South Florida, or Central Florida, to meet Buddy Ebsen and give back the crocodile.
Here's my question. How has this not been turned into a movie?
It should be. And in fact, Jake Gyllenhaal should option it, because he would have played the son, and then he would be playing the father as a young married man. It's a perfect role for him. It's a really good novel, very entertaining, very picaresque. It's got a great role for him. He really should. They've stayed sort of vague friends, he and Homer Hickam. But, you know, he really should option it, because it would make a great movie role for him. A nice, light, fun, romantic leading role. He hasn't had that in a while. But anyway, when I went to interview Homer Hickam about this book, I, of course, was Googling him and reading up about his life and reading as many of his books as I could, many of which are quite good, not just October Sky. And I'm like, oh, it's a movie musical. Oh, they turned it into a musical. And I'm reading up. There's another musical. What's going on? So suddenly I'm figuring, I'm like, how are there two musicals based on October Sky? Well, here's your answer. He was doing one. Universal ended up doing another. They've both been staged regionally, and he was hoping the Universal one would be horrible and therefore would just disappear from view and he could go take his to Broadway, which is what he wants to do. But they're suing each other. So it's just a fun little story. Great book if you've never read October Sky. Read the sequels. Read Carrying Albert Home, because Jake Gyllenhaal, if you're friends with Jake, let him know he should option that book and turn that into a movie as well.
Well, you know, Michael, The Angry Birds might be your favorite movie based on a mobile app. I finally got that joke out right.
Well,
but I'm wondering if The Emoji Movie would be your favorite movie based on a mobile character.
Yeah,
mobile typeface. I don't know what
Sony is making The Emoji Movie. Good God. Sounds like his worse idea than The Angry Birds Movie. But who knows? Maybe it's a good script. And some German company, they haven't copyrighted those emoji characters that you know about, the smiley face and such. How could you? But they have created all sorts of other emojis, and they've copyrighted them, and they're somehow claiming, oh no, you can't make a movie without, you're treading on our copyrights. We own Emoji Town, we own Emoji World, they've copyrighted all this stuff, and they're suing Sony to say, oh, you owe us money. And Sony responded with an emoji crying tears, another emoji that was red with anger, and a third emoji with angel wings and a halo insisting they were innocent. I don't know if that holds up in court, but that's what they did.
I do think that their response to it was very, very funny.
What did they say?
that they responded with emojis.
Did they?
I don't know. I thought that was true.
No, I was just joking.
Oh, I read that in the it's part of the story. I thought that was part of the story. And I read the funny thing is I read the article and I was like, I don't remember reading that part. But boy, that's a really funny way to respond. We should be comedians. We're pretty good at this.
No, we shouldn't.
Okay, fine.
Keep going.
Now, maybe we should start our own streaming service, just like Spotify. And, you know, they're going it alone over there at Spotify. They're ignoring the path trod by Twitter and Amazon and so many other e-companies and are trotting out a plan to actually, and get this, Michael, I know this is going to floor you. They want to make what's called a profit. And I don't mean
that's stupid. We're not doing that. Why should they?
Yeah, I don't.
Send money to Showbiz them.
Yeah.
I need a new laptop, people.
I was actually going to make a joke about a profit like the kind, you know, like a prophet, like Jesus or somebody.
Oh, all right. So what is happening at Spotify?
Well, it sounds radical, this whole profit notion, but Fortune insists the plan has two main features. One, the mobile music app is going to reduce its dependence on music labels by creating more original content, like interviews with artists and pop-ups that explain lyrics. Two, they're going to invest in algorithms that learn users' tastes so Spotify can offer personalized services like concert recommendations and suggest artist memorabilia. On top of that, they're launching in Japan, a market where music sales have remained surprisingly stable, at least physical musical sales, and streaming services, they've been really slow to grow. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I have to say a big whoop, right? I mean, what the hell? They're not investing in algorithms? Weren't they from day one?
Yeah.
You know, what is that about? That's like, what do you mean? You haven't been doing that all along? Making sure you can make good recommendations and maybe sell them extra stuff like, oh, I don't know, you listen to 14 albums by Styx. Maybe you want a ticket to the Styx concert and or some Styx memorabilia.
I'm not even going to, you know, for those of you who don't know who Styx are, Try the 1980s.
Or 70s.
Yeah, good point.
Come Sail Away. And then the other one. Oh, yes. No one's going to want to listen to music on Spotify. We're going to spend $8 a month because they've got artist interviews and pop-ups explaining lyrics. That's lovely bonus features, but that's not why people go to Spotify.
That is correct. In fact, when I'm on the treadmill at the gym and I have Spotify on, I never look at the pop-ups.
They have pop-ups?
No, they don't. So, yeah.
Oh, well, they're planning to. But boy, those are both either things they should have been doing long ago or lovely additions, but that is not a plan to make a profit.
I would agree with that.
And that wraps up Big Deal, Big Whoop, doesn't it?
Indeed, it does wrap up Big Deal, Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're going to be talking about the LA Times, the Los Angeles Times. They ran a really impressive feature about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. You might know them as the folks that vote for the Oscars. They ran this piece last week, and we had to have them on to talk about it. A little background first. In 2012, the Los Angeles Times analyzed who votes on the Oscars and found that 96% of those voting for the Oscars are white, and 77% of them were male. In fact, we had Nicole Sperling on in February of 2012 on episode 137 to discuss that very study. The Academy at the time promised change. Cut to 2016, and the LA Times did it again. Very little has changed. 91% of the members are white, and 76% are male. The Academy promised to change yet again. Then the LA Times decided to help them out. They canvassed Hollywood and their staff, coming up with the countless names that could and should be asked to join the Academy, improve diversity, and put them in touch with the people who actually go to the movies. They winnowed that list down to 100 and posted their results online, and of course, in Sunday's paper. Here to talk with us about this project is Travell Anderson, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, in fact, the staff writer in charge of putting this whole piece together. Travell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first question, how long have you been working on this project? Because it's a big project.
We've been working on this. The idea first came to us in the height of Oscar So White coverage during awards season. And we thought this would be a great way to kind of continue the conversation after awards season. So we've been working on it for about two and a half months. And we finally published it last week. And then it came out in our Sunday issue.
Well, is part of it that you were just sitting around saying, well, okay, who could the Academy invite that would increase diversity?
Well, we basically kind of took our cue from some of the interviews that we had done. I first interviewed April Rain. She's the creator of the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite. And she spoke about basically being a woman of color herself and wanting to see people who looked like her on screen, and how that was also important to see people of color, people of diverse background behind the scenes, in particular in the Academy when it came to recognizing these different types of films. As we continued our coverage and my colleagues interviewed, you know, Academy members and different people in the industry, we realized that there were some sentiments going around, one of which was that there weren't enough, you know, people of diverse background qualified enough to be members of the Academy. And so with those two things in mind, we set out to create this list of a variety of diverse people. We have race, we have gender, we have sexuality, and we wanted to show that not only do they qualify based on, you know, some of the strict requirements that the Academy already has, but if we even, you know, reconsider some of these requirements of the Academy that are already on their face exclusionary for certain types of people, we can open it up to a more qualified, more diverse, more representative body.
And of course, you could just say, and you know what? A lot of these people are famous. People already know who they are. They can't believe that Idris Elba is not a member of the Academy. Should have been nominated for an Oscar last year.
Right. A lot of them, many of them are people that you know. They're, you know, the big name people, your Laverne Coxes, your Aziz Ansaris, Tina Fey, Eva Longoria. But it's also a lot of people that we don't talk about. The Academy has about 23 branches, I believe. We covered 17 of them, cinematographers, agents, associates, executives, different people, public relations people, to really kind of, you know, diversify the Academy. And when you look at it, it's a lot of those other branches that you don't think about that are the least diverse. So the actors branch happens to be the most diverse.
Well, and actually, speaking of which, you just mentioned a number of names. Tina Fey, of course, she's been in a lot of movies and everybody knows that. But you mentioned Aziz Ansari, Eva Longoria, and Laverne Cox. I know Laverne mm-hmm. Cox from Orange is the New Black, which some would say is not even a television show since it streams online. mm-hmm. But of course, I would. I think it's a wonderful hour-long drama. You know, a lot of these names, this was the first thing that struck me. Hey, there are a lot of TV people here.
Very much so. I mean, and that was part of the conversation that we had was what is TV? What is film these days when you have streaming services like Hulu, like Netflix, like Amazon Prime, you know, in the game? They're kind of redefining, you know, what we've traditionally thought to be film versus television. But when you look at a lot of these people, they are the people in Hollywood who really have the chance to push us forward in terms of diversity, in terms of diversifying the representations of people that we see on TV. You know, Laverne Cox, though a lot of people know her for Orange is the New Black, she's also been in a variety of other projects. She has a documentary, she's on the producing side of a documentary coming out called Free Cece about Black trans women. She's acted in Grandma opposite Lily Tomlin. She's been in another of other projects. She'll be in Rocky Horror Picture Show coming up this year. So there's a lot of these people who, you know, you could see in TV or the film area. But when you look at the industry, the lines are really becoming blurred. And so we wanted to take that into account into our list.
And if we put aside all those people, you could still say, hey, you still got 80 people that should be in the Academy. You know, before you get caught up in worrying about whether they're TV or film, you know, there's a lot of people who are clearly film based. And frankly, it's hard to find anyone who doesn't have some TV and some film credits, no matter where they mostly work. So there's a lot of crossover. But I wonder, you talked about all the tech areas like casting, sound, and visual effects. And it was harder, I imagine, for you to find people of color and people and women and people of different sexual orientations who were working in there and that you could nominate. It probably was a little bit harder than in some of the more visible categories.
It definitely wasn't harder. I mean, it definitely was harder, but it wasn't impossible. And the fact that we were able to do it, right, shows that other people should be able to do it as well. And we did a simple thing of, you know, just, you know, looking up some of these diverse films that have gotten a variety of attention by their target audiences and looking into the credits, seeing who did the costumes on this movie or who did the casting for this movie. We also reached out to the National Hispanic Media Coalition, OutFest, which is an LGBT festival out here, the Pan-African Film Festival, the American Black Film Festival, all these different kind of, you know, niche industry communities that really kind of have a leaning in a area of expertise that even us being a part of the media might overlook. And that's where we got a lot of our names from, those names that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
But now what are people saying about, say, John Boyega? He starred in, Star Wars, actually, the last mm-hmm. Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
He's going to star in Pacific Rim.
Okay.
Pacific Rim 2. So, yeah, he's a hot Hollywood actor.
And I look at a name like that, not to say that he's not deserving, but I almost wonder, gee, he's been in one film that people can mention, maybe two, and all of a sudden in the Academy, whereas some people spend a lifetime trying to get a body of work that's worthy of being in the Academy. Is there some concern? I mean, granted, this is not a list that is of invitees. It's kind of suggestions. Was there some thought to, gee, you know, this person doesn't have enough tenure yet?
We had that conversation, but with someone like John Boyega, he actually has a very long career of working in African film that a lot of people don't know about. You know, a lot of people know Star Wars because that's where he kind of blew up, but he's been in a variety of other American projects as well as a long career, respected career, particularly in Nigeria and in Africa. And so that's when you see a lot of people, the Film Academy is really this internationally recognized body. You have people from, you know, who are based in Asia, people who are based in Africa, who are members of the Academy, and their membership is supposed to diversify the types of things that we recognize, right? And so with John Boyega in particular, not only is he on an amazing rise right now here in the States, he's already been working for years in his hometown. And we thought this was a great way to recognize that work that he's been doing and to also show that, you know, we can't deny the fact that one of the reasons why Star Wars is doing the amazing numbers that it has done is because he, as a Black person, is one of the leads of the project.
Well, start a woman and a Black man, exactly.
Yes, a woman and a Black man.
And you mentioned the international connection there with John Boyega. You kind of went international in a number of areas, a number of the categories, including acting and directing. I was surprised Zhang Yimou wasn't a part of the Academy or a member of the Academy already. He is a Chinese filmmaker who has, I mean, his movies have been nominated for Oscars numerous times.
Yeah, we came across a lot of situations of people who actually have been nominated for Oscars and for whatever reason aren't members yet. Which kind of raised the question, because theoretically, once you have received a nomination, it should be a whole lot easier for you to become a member. But those, again, you know, I think shows the lapses, if you will, in some of these Academy procedures that really leave certain people out.
Right. I mean, you look at Hayao Miyazaki, one of the most famous filmmakers of all time, the legendary animation genius ranking with Disney, and he just got entered into the Academy. They were like, oh, yeah, maybe we should, that guy that we've nominated for multiple Oscars who's been wildly influential, maybe he should be in the Academy, too. There are bizarre lapses all over the world, aren't there?
Yeah, and there are countless people, a number of interesting people on our list who have really been in the industry for 10, 15, 20 years, you know, much longer than John Boyega, right? And still aren't in the Academy. But that goes to show, you know, some of the criticisms that have been lodged toward the Academy are really valid in terms of them somehow not recognizing certain talent, but recognizing others.
So now, have you had any response?
Well, from the Academy specifically.
Yeah.
Not yet. We do know is that they are in the process, and they've already, you know, been in the process for some time of doing their own work and working with people. A couple of the people that we actually interviewed and did profiles on, we know that the Academy has already reached out to them and is walking them through the application process to become members. And so we don't know. We haven't had a conversation. At least I haven't had a conversation with the Academy yet. But they will be announcing their invitees typically later this month. But we'll see how that all works out.
I mean, I'm always wondering why it wouldn't necessarily increase diversity, but it seems to me, obviously, if you get nominated for Academy Award, you should automatically get membership in the Academy. It's like, if you're good enough to get nominated as a cinematographer or for even for your short film, you should be a member of the Academy.
Yeah, and like I said, that is one of the listed, you know, requirements, right, for people who can become members. But somehow, once again, there's someone somewhere drops the ball in terms of following through to make sure that those people, many of which, you know, are on this list and are of diverse background, would help diversify the body itself.
Well, and you said that the Academy is walking some of the folks that you have picked in this, your diverse 100, as you're calling it, that they're walking them through the application process. And it is a process. It is not just, you know, here, fill out this form and pay $100 and you're in.
Well, it should be like that. It should be here, fill out this form, pay $100 and you're in. Why would you make it a complicated process?
Well, I mean, because, you know, they didn't
no
want...
No good reason.
Well, they just didn't want everybody. They'd be flooded with people
asking...
It's
your gang. If you could decide who's in. It shouldn't be complicated.
Well, I know that you have to get at least two members to nominate you. That much.
Yeah, it's a very complicated process, and it's very a long process. I mean, I know people who are in the industry who've been trying to get into the Film Academy for, you know, 10 years, right? But just have been able to do it in the last couple of years. So it's a process, and it does take time. But this, we are hoping that this list at least points them in the direction of some people that they might not have thought about, particularly a lot of the categories that are, you know, the most white of the Academy, like the public relations branch, like the executive branch.
Mm-hmm. And those are categories I think most people don't even know exist.
Right, very much so. Like most people, you know, you think of the categories, you look at producers, you look at actors, you look at directors. You don't think of public relations, you don't think of costume designers, you don't think of cinematographers. They have a members at large branch, they have two associates branches, you know, executives. There's, like I said, 23 total branches, and we typically only focus on maybe two or three of them. And so the purpose of this project was to uplift some of those names that people already know, but to really shine a light on the other names that people don't talk about often.
Well, Travel, I know when people love lists, and when you're doing a list, people start to pay attention. I know when Premiere Magazine or Entertainment Weekly would do a power list, people would advocate to get on it. Or if you're doing the 10 biggest movies of the upcoming summer that we're all excited by, people want to be on that list. When word got out that you were working on this project, did people reach out to you and say, hey, I want to be on the list?
Well, we had a number of, you know, publicists, right? When we would contact them for one specific person to talk to them or get their headshot, they would want to pitch other people, right, that they represent. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like actual individuals, we didn't have any of that. You know, it was really kind of a project that we kept as in-house as possible and only reached out to, you know, the particular individuals when that time came within the last couple of weeks. In terms of getting photos and finalizing interviews. But I think when you look at it, there are countless people of diverse background with amazing credits who have a perspective, a unique perspective that the broader industry does not pay attention to, is not paying attention to, but they serve an audience that really wants to see themselves represented in front of and behind the camera. And so it was a great process, a great long process, but it was a great process of finding these names and putting this list together.
Well, is your next list going to be a list of all of the Academy members that should no longer have the privilege to vote because they haven't worked in 10 years or, you know, their movies haven't done well? Because I know that was kind of a controversial move that the Academy made. They said, look, if you're not working, your voting privileges kind of, you have to work every 10 years to keep your voting privileges up. And I guess, well, first of all, you'd have to have a list of the Academy members, which they are loath to ever create.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like you said, in addition to the Academy announcing a commitment to diversify their body by doubling the amount of women and people of color by 2020, they also augmented their membership rules. Like you said, you have to have worked three separate 10-year periods for lifetime membership. And then there's a particular kind of quirk about voting rights, lifetime voting rights, and things like that. And a lot of people, a lot of current Academy members, many of them older, many of those old white men, as we have highlighted the Academy are, you know, were a little upset. They thought it was a little ageist. They thought it was a little problematic that they would no longer have their voting rights. And so, you know, who knows? That might become a list in the future. But I think that the goal at least is to diversify the body. And I think I'm reminded of the interview I did with April Rain, and she talked about how a lot of these people, because they're no longer involved in the industry, right, they may not have a particular idea of who Ryan Coogler is, right, and his amazing work, or who Michael B. Jordan is and his amazing work. And so when they get those screeners, they don't go for the Creed or the Straight Outta Compton. They go for the films with the people and the names that they most recognize. And so by requiring people to stay involved into the industry in some way, you necessitate them being aware of some of these new vibrant names coming through, many of which happen to be people of color and of diverse background.
So if you've got screeners for a film with Ryan Coogler, Straight Outta Compton, and a film with Dame Judi Dench in it, and you go for the Dame Judi Dench film first, you probably shouldn't be voting. That was a joke, by the way.
Oh, well, but the thing is, the point about that, right, is that it's a lot of screeners that you get, and you're going to go to the screeners that have people in them that you know first.
Oh, yeah,
and
true.
You might not ever get to the Straight Outta Compton or to the Creed or to the, you know, the Beast of No Nation. And so I think that's the kind of, so it's a joke. You know, my grandmother used to say, you know, truth is told in jest, right? There is some truth to that. You're going to go to the people that you recognize first. There is some truth to that. You're going to go to the people that you recognize first.
That's true. But the truth is that those rules about age and how long you have nothing to do with diversity. And they were just slapped in there. So they felt like they were doing something, and they were kind of stupid anyway. And let's leave Dame Judi Dench out of it.
Okay, fine. Well, certainly, Travell Anderson with the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I don't know what the piece is called. Is it called Our Diverse 100 or Opening
Doors?
Yes, it's
called Our Diverse 100, 100 people we feel could fix the Academy's diversity problem.
Well, we'll certainly be placing links to it in our show notes, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Showbiz Sandbox.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, that was great of Travell Anderson to stop by. I'll have to pay attention to more of his stories down the road.
Yeah, actually, I always love having reporters from the Los Angeles Times come on to discuss the articles and stories they're working on, because you know what? They are in the thick of it.
And certainly when it comes to covering Hollywood.
That's what
I
mean,
course,
yeah.
They're in the thick of covering Prince. Even though he's died, there's a lot of information to be done. We covered his death, of course, a few weeks ago, and sadly, we found out that he did, in fact, die of opioid overdose.
Yes, of fentanyl, and we're not going to get into what fentanyl is, and there's a whole epidemic of opioid abuse in the United States going on right now. It
was really a shock, though, because Prince was always no drinking, no drugs. If you're in his band, you don't drink or do drugs. If you get in trouble, he'll help you get rehab, but you're not going to do drinking and drugs when you're on tour with him. So to find out that he was had this addiction to these pills was really a shock. And people, even in his inner circle, just were filled with disbelief. So it's very sad. Apparently, he was about to get help. He was talking to people, had a meeting set up like literally the next day in order to start rehab perhaps, or consult and consider it. So it's a real shame, of course, that would happen. It's a really sad news, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're not going to get into, like I said, the whole addiction thing, but it is one of those things that you go in for an operation and you're on that kind of opioid painkiller for, you know, a month, and trying to get off of it can be very, very difficult. And unfortunately, it requires more and more and more to reach the same level of, I don't know, it's not only pain management, but also withdrawal management.
Yeah. Well, you know, and other people died, of course, this week Muhammad Ali died, but I thought, there have been great documentary films about Ali involving his fights and stuff, but what's the point of covering that? Everyone's going to cover it. It's not, I mean, unless we'd met him, there really wouldn't be any point in talking about Muhammad Ali on our show.
Ah, now there you go. As a matter of fact, I have met him on three separate occasions.
Really?
Yes. The last two were, of course, when he was promoting King of the Jungle, I think was the name.
Rumble in the Jungle.
Rumble in the Jungle, whatever the documentary was. It was a great documentary. Then, of course, Ali, the biopic. But probably the most memorable and the first time I ever met him was in 1982-83 at my elementary school in Teaneck, New Jersey, at Whittier Elementary. I was showed up for school one Friday, and there was Muhammad Ali. His daughter, Mia Ali, was in the fifth grade, one grade below me. And he just showed up, and, you know, even in 1982, though, Michael, he could barely speak. Nobody could understand anything he was saying. None of the kids could. And at the time, Parkinson's wasn't mentioned because, let's face it, none of the kids would understand what Parkinson's was in the first place. Mm-hmm. But everybody just thought, wow, that's what happens when you're a boxer. You could really hurt yourself. Look at Muhammad Ali.
It's true.
I mean, he was standing there. We all kind of went to the gym, and, you know, there he was, the champ, as everybody kept calling him. And the principal talked to him, and he addressed the students, and he wouldn't sign autographs because his signature was so bad. Yeah. And so he signed one autograph that everybody, you know, that got a Xerox copy of. But that was, you know, a very, very memorable moment in my childhood.
Wow, that's very cool. So I assume the documentary you mean that he was promoting was When We Were Kings?
Thank you. I knew it was something to do with King. Yeah.
1996. Terrific documentary. And won the Academy Award, actually, for Best Documentary Film. Well watching. There's a ton of stuff out there about Ali, but that's certainly one of the great ones. It just gives you a sense of how magnetic and charismatic he was on camera when he wasn't, you know, knocked for a loop by all that boxing and Parkinson's.
Yeah, that's why I decided not to actually take up boxing.
Well, that and you didn't want to die.
Yeah, I'm the wimpy kid from that diary.
That's right.
Okay, well.
So no show next week.
No show next week, but you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to the show. You can rate and review the show. In fact, we do encourage you to do so. We do love it when you rate and review the show. It does help us out. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. And I'd like to thank Travell Anderson from the Los Angeles Times for joining us to discuss our Diverse 100, the story they did on, I don't know, how to diversify the Oscars, or at least the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. It's worth checking out. We'll place a link to that in our show notes. Our website is also where you can find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and up our page should come. Please do like us there. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's, hey, I'm diverse, put me in the academy.com.
I don't know. know about that, Michael. I got to check into that word diverse. You might want to look that one up in the dictionary.
Gay.
Oh, oh, yeah. Fine.
That's diverse.
Oh,
I'm diverser than you are.
I'm looking the word diverser up. I don't even think that's a word.
You're straight white male. I'm surprised you're not supporting Trump.
Oh, my God. If there was ever a time to end the show, now would be it. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on whatever that website was, why not head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his coverage of the entertainment industry there? Or, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com is where all of his work is aggregated. Or you can head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
Next week, I'll just have to talk to myself.
Wait, don't you do that all the time anyway?
Yes, I do, actually. I'm not kidding.